Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is geologist Robert Gilkerson. Since 2002, Robert Gilkerson has worked pro bono on contamination and seismic issues at Los Alamos National Weapons Laboratory and at Sandia Nuclear Weapons Laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico. From 1988 to 1999, he was a senior consultant to Los Alamos National Laboratory on environmental contamination issues from laboratory operations. Gilkerson has been a research scientist and geologist at the University of Illinois and was technical editor for the journal Groundwater Monitoring Review for 10 years. In 1999, Gilkerson accepted assignment with Honeywell Corporation to work with their attorneys to design a strategy for a $100 million lawsuit between Honeywell and Motorola for groundwater contamination below the city of Phoenix, Arizona. Honeywell won the lawsuit, much to the surprise of Motorola, and I suppose Bob Gilkerson. Robert Gilkerson, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you.
Now, I've received a very long sort of memo from you about Los Alamos National Labs. I think for the benefit of the audience, we really need to walk through step by step what the lab is, what its history is, what it's been doing for many years, and what they want to do now, which is very important. So can you give us a little history, Robert, of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, please, in New Mexico?
Certainly. Los Alamos National Laboratory was the place where the nuclear weapon was invented that was dropped on two nuclear weapons that were used to end World War II by dropping those weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Weapons work has always been a centerpiece at Los Alamos National Laboratory, but they've also done important work in the sciences. They have very capable people at that laboratory. But what concerns me now is that the laboratory is progressively moving into being the major complex for doing work on modernization of the nuclear weapons complex. And this is beginning with the construction of a new Walmart-sized, a super Walmart-sized facility for production of components for plutonium triggers, which are the trigger that sets off the hydrogen bombs in our current technology.
Right, so modernization, what on earth does that mean in this day and age? When America, over the Cold War, built 77,000 hydrogen bombs, mostly hydrogen bombs, when 1,000 dropping on 100 cities would create nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth, they've now got down to about, their estimates vary, but 9,000 to 10,000 hydrogen bombs, and they want to modernize. Now, what does that mean, Robert?
Well, it means a waste of money, which we cannot afford to do now with the pressures we have in our economy, and looking forward to possibly losing benefits for our people in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Well, we know it's a waste of money, but the term modernization, is that a euphemism? What exactly do they mean?
Modernization means a new design not only for the nuclear weapons, but also for the delivery system. So this is This is an operation between the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense, and what I'm aware of now is its planned spending of $180 billion over the next 10 years, and it won't stop. And, of course, my experience with the Department of Energy is that costs are always doubled, at least. And it's a program that we don't need, and I'm afraid it will start a new arms race. And the other part about this is there's discussion between Congress and the executive branch that as we trim down our nuclear weapon delivery capability as part of the START treaty, that we need to retarget those weapons to the civilian population instead of taking out enemy, whoever the enemy is, defense capabilities or first strike capabilities. So this is changing the arms race from first strike to deliberate targeting of cities.
Yes, the terminology for those particular policies are counter force is targeting specifically not the, I mean, let's face it, it's stupid to talk about enemies, but I will use that euphemism, the enemy's military capabilities like factories and missile fields, mostly missile fields. But counter value means targeting cities. Now, there's always been a struggle between what do you target, countervalue or counterforce, and in fact, America's official policy was probably to do both, although they wouldn't admit to that. But now there are people in the Congress, you are saying, Robert, who are talking about, because there'll be fewer weapons, they'll target cities and kill many more people than targeting missile facilities. Is that right?
That's the discussion that's going on.
Yeah, but you know,
it's all absurd.
It's absurd because, in fact, at the moment, Russia has New York targeted with 40 hydrogen bombs, and probably Moscow's targeted with 60. So,
sure.
The story—I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous, fantasy, really kind of a mental illness. I would say. But anyway, so why? Give us a history. Why did Obama decide to allocate $180 billion at this time of gross financial problems to building new nuclear weapons and new missiles to deliver them? Why did he decide to do that in relationship to the new START treaty he negotiated with Medvedev?
I'm not an expert on those politics. Of course, it's a political decision, and of course, it involves the military-industrial complex power on lobbying.
Oh, well, I'll tell you why.
Okay.
There's a man called Senator Kyle, who's a really bad Republican, who said, I will not allow the Senate to ratify your new START treaty with Russia unless you allocate, you know, $180 billion for new nuclear weapons. And so in order to get his START treaty ratified, Obama agreed to that, which was ridiculous, number one. And number two, when it came to ratification and the vote, Kyle voted against it. So
right,
that's,
I'm aware of that.
Yeah,
yes,
that's
that a nice story.
Oh, not nice. It's just, well, I think it's wicked. But anyway, so we get back to Los Alamos Labs. They want to build this new facility. What's it called? Something about chemicals or something. What's the name they're ascribing to it, Robert?
Well, okay, here's the history on that. At the beginning of the arms race, there was a very large-sized research facility constructed, which was called the Chemical and Metallurgy Research Facility, CMRFC, Facility Complex. And I was a consultant at Los Alamos Laboratory when they did a drilling investigation and they discovered there was an active fault underneath that building. I was watching that drilling program and the reaction by the LANL scientists when they discovered the fault.
When was this?
1997, 1998.
Right.
In fact, they used refined core core drilling techniques that I brought to Los Alamos Laboratory.
Mm.
And they were bragging about how they got practically 100% recovery of the drilling operations. But I brought that drilling capability to the laboratory and fine-tuned it.
Now, okay, so for us, Robert Gilkerson, how, by drilling, do you work out exactly that there's an active earthquake fault? I don't know any geology, so can you explain that to us?
Oh, yes. Thank you for asking. Active earthquake faults may cause displacements across the fault zone. And that's what they discovered with this drilling program of drilling many core holes. Some of the core holes actually drilled through the fault zone, and there's evidence of a fault zone in terms of the mineralogy of the strata that are affected by the fault action. And then in addition, the core holes away from that fault zone on both sides of it discovered a vertical offset of like 20 feet.
What is the vertical?
The strata were 20 feet down on the down thrown side of the fault as compared to the up thrown side is the terminology. So it was actually an offset in the strata.
Okay, now I don't really understand what you've said. I don't understand. Tell us what you see when you drill down and you find an earthquake fault. What do you see in the rock that defines the earthquake fault?
Well, if you drill right into the fault itself, there's going to be rubble and slicken sides that's formed by the more resistant rock strata rubbing against each other.
Mm.
And it actually forms a new mineralogy, which is called gouge.
Oh.
But the reason, the geologic strata at Los Alamos National Laboratory and can be considered to be a layer cake.
Different layers
that are laid down.
Yeah.
One above the other.
Mm.
And they have differences in character between the layers.
Mm.
And so when for identification of faults, it's very important to see that this layer cake is offset.
Well, what do you mean offset? I don't understand that term.
Across the fault location, one layer is up higher.
Oh.
And then is suddenly down a good distance on the other side of the fault.
Meaning that there has been an earthquake already there. Is that right?
Yes, right.
Ah.
There was already an earthquake in the below that original chemical and metallurgy research facility, which, by the way, is still in operation, even though they discovered this active fault below it in 1997. And, by the way, the plan off into the future is that facility is still going to be used for research purposes with nuclear materials till the year 2023.
Okay, so let's get down to the bottom line. They're going to put, 6 tons of plutonium in that lab sitting directly over an active earthquake fault. Is that what you're saying?
No, the 6 metric tons, which is 13,228 pounds for us here in the United States, is planned to be in a secure vault inside this new supersized facility that they're planning to build as replacement for the original CMR facility.
Yeah, but built over an active earthquake fault.
No, we can't say it's built. It's built in an active seismic zone.
Okay, seismic zone. I don't understand the difference between a fault and a zone.
Oh, well, the geologic setting at this proposed location for this new facility isn't adequately understood for knowledge of how close an active fault may be located to the facility. That's a point of contention.
Yeah.
And the LANL Seismic Hazards Geology Team has focused on identifying faults present at the ground surface. zones of intense fracturing. And this is commonly used as an indication of active faulting, is are there zones where the rock strata are severely fractured? And that is taken as evidence that an active fault is somewhere close and possibly buried.
Yeah.
Buried below the ground surface, and so there's no physical fault offset at this time. But here's the other part of the problem. The geologic setting at Lanel is very young, and that's because of a very powerful supervolcano that erupted twice, the first time 1.6 million years ago, and then 1.26 million years ago, and the product of those two eruptions was putting down a new deposit as geologic layers down to a depth of 700 feet at the proposed location for this new facility. And this new layer of rock strata, which was volcanic ash, was deposited over a pre-existing network of faults that goes back to being around 16 to 20 million years old.
Right.
And this new thick layer of rock strata re-energized that existing fault system, and it is propagating upward from depth through the Bandelier Tuff. The new layer of rocks is called the Bandelier Tuff, and the faults are now forming and working their way upward through this new layer, and many have reached ground surface. Others are buried in the subsurface, and the way to identify those, one method is to use this technique of careful mapping of zones of intense fractures as an early warning that a buried active fault is present.
I'm interviewing Robert Gilkerson, who from 1988 to 1999 was a senior consultant to Los Alamos National Labs on environmental contamination issues, and he's a research scientist and a geologist. Okay, so what you're saying is that the lab has been built on ground that is geologically unstable, that prognostically no one knows whether or not or when there could be a major earthquake. Is that what you would say?
Yes, that's very true.
But how long have they known this at the lab? For how many years? Since 1999 when they did that drilling, or earlier?
No, certainly earlier. They knew of this seismic hazard setting at the laboratory for certainly, I would say, at least the last 30 years.
Okay, so over the years, when they first started designing and building nuclear weapons there in the early 40s, they must have had a huge amount of radioactive material there, including plutonium, one of the most toxic substances on Earth, and other such substances at the lab over those, 60 years, right?
Oh, that's true. Yes.
And they knew it was an unstable. So why don't you then, Robert Gilkerson, summarize for us in this new huge Walmart-type building where they want to make new plutonium triggers or pits of about 10 pounds in size and weight for new nuclear weapons, and in the process will be storing about 6 tons or metric tons of plutonium in this new building. What is your worry, concern, and prognosis as a geologist for what they are planning to do here at this site?
Well, my concern is that they don't adequately understand the seismic hazard to even have the knowledge for the design of this new facility. And on that issue, I came to In 2009, I came up to Santa Fe for a meeting with Joni Ahrens at her office, and Joni was away unexpectedly for another meeting. And I found that there were books about the seismic hazard at Llano sitting on her table. And I started reading those and became alarmed that these books didn't present accurate knowledge of the seismic hazard. And I'm not a seismic hazard expert. I am just very well rounded in the earth sciences.
Mm.
I deliberately took courses, and especially for my master's degree, that crossed the disciplines in the earth sciences. And so just sitting and reading these books for the half hour before Joni came, I was alarmed that they obviously didn't have the necessary design for this new facility. And I had a discussion with Joni, and we decided I was going to write a paper about the design not being adequate for the seismic hazard.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take it out to a meeting with the Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board in Washington, D.C. And so we co-authored a paper together and traveled to Washington, D.C. and presented it to the seismic hazard experts in that agency. And the reason we had to do that and do it on short notice is we knew that they were required to report that the design was safe and efficient to Congress. And I knew it wasn't safe, and I wanted to make sure I brought it to their attention. And at that time, the proposed cost for this new facility was $300 million. After our visit to Washington, D.C., the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board filed a report that found the design to be deficient, and the cost suddenly went up to $6 billion.
Well, was that because you instigated concern and they knew they had to change the design?
There's no record. I pointed out the reasons that the seismic hazard was, that obvious features about the unstable geologic setting at that location, and the design was not adequate to... the basic problem is that there's a weak layer of geologic materials in the subsurface. All of these materials were deposited as volcanic ash in airfall
mm-hmm.
deposits, and some of these airfall deposits are loose. They're basically fluffy volcanic ash, very low...
pumice.
Strength.
Yeah.
Not even pumice. It's just loose volcanic ash.
Really?
Very low strength.
Really?
And there's a 50-foot thick layer of fluffy volcanic ash below that proposed facility.
Well, so if there was an earthquake underneath this fluffy volcanic ash, right below the facility, what would happen?
That fluffy material has poor bearing strength to begin with.
What does bearing strength mean? I don't know.
Ability to carry weight, ability to support weight.
Yeah.
And
so the building could subside.
Yes, the building, that's exactly the point. And the earthquake activity, the motions from the shaking from the earthquake puts an up and down motion on the building, and the building has a huge weight.
Mm-hmm.
And the shaking also further disaggregates and fluffs up the fluffy volcanic ash.
The fluffy layer. So the building could, in fact, disintegrate. Is that what you're saying?
The building could have serious damage, and it's not the kind of building that you want to have 6 metric tons of weapons-grade plutonium.
All right. Well, now, how are they going to store the 6 metric tons? Because if you put 10 pounds of plutonium together, you get critical mass and a spontaneous nuclear explosion. So they must be storing the 6 metric tons of plutonium in separate little integrated places, each less than 10 pounds. So I mean, I'd love to know the design of the storage of the 6 metric tons of plutonium. Do you know anything about that, Robert?
No, but of course you have to have discrete containers which are controlled for temperature and and controlling the plutonium coming close together and going critical.
So, okay, so let's
obvious factors.
Okay, let's go to the worst case scenario, which in medicine, and you know I'm a physician, we always do to prevent our patients dying. And I know engineers always do that too, so bridges don't collapse and the like. So here we have 6 metric tons of plutonium, each in discrete little packages in a special container in this new building that they want to build. And then we have an earthquake underneath this this fluffy layer of ash from previous volcanoes. And so let's walk us through, if you will, the worst case scenario of what could happen to the 6 metric tons of plutonium stored in this building when an active earthquake is occurring.
Well, it could be released. And
what could be released? How could it be released?
The action of the earthquake cuts off the engineering controls that are in place for maintaining that material as being safe in the vault. You know, I mean, that has to be an energy supply. It's a very serious. It's a difficult engineering process to build a vault to store that quantity of plutonium. And on that topic, at this same location at LANL 20 years ago, they built a facility specifically for the purpose of storing plutonium, and they did the design and construction of that facility so terribly that they couldn't get safe storage of the plutonium, and they bulldozed the facility out of existence.
Okay, so that didn't work.
That's a story that a lot of people don't know, is the huge amount of money that they spent to build a facility specifically for storing plutonium was unsuccessful.
Now, isn't that so classical, and yet they're going to thinking of cutting Social Security because they want to spend more money on this absolutely ridiculously dangerous, ridiculously sort of fantasized idea of storing plutonium.
And I have to say, what are they thinking? In the design of this building, the plan is to have tunnels deep underground that connect over to an existing plutonium facility there that's getting to have a lot of age now. And they've already built a new radiological and office capability laboratory that's part of this new complex, and it's now connected by tunnel over to this older plutonium facility, and it will be connected by a deep tunnel to this new facility. This new facility is going to have a depth, it's going to have 4 floors, and 3 of the floors are going to be buried in the subsurface.
Yeah, just near the earthquake fault.
So why don't they put the plutonium storage building as a separate building buried in the Bandelier Tuff? That's the most secure setting to put it, and not have it as any part of another big, huge Walmart-sized, super Walmart-sized building that for laboratory work and offices. Well, that's what I would. Well, I wouldn't do it in the first place.
Well, we mustn't do it. We've got to stop them. But from a medical perspective, let me just sort of paint this scenario. So you've got 6 metric tons of plutonium when 10 pounds is critical mass, and you have an earthquake and the building starts disintegrating and falling apart, and you get critical mass within the 6 metric tons, and you have a massive, like massive nuclear explosion scattering 6 metric tons of plutonium in aerosolized form to the four winds in New Mexico, which will then be blown around the northern hemisphere in the stratosphere and the troposphere. And knowing that theoretically, hypothetically, 1 pound, if adequately distributed, could probably give everyone on Earth lung cancer, such that a millionth of, well, 10 to the minus 9 grams is probably carcinogenic. I mean, I think that people need to know why you and I and others are so deeply concerned about what these crazy scientists are deciding to do. And also, I would say, the politicians in Washington who, to my knowledge and experience, are scientifically and medically illiterate. Like, what on earth do these people think they are doing? Robert,
yes, that was well said, Dr. Caldicott. Thank you.
I mean, it is so insane. I feel like tearing my hair out. How do we stop these people who are... I mean, I'm reminded of the Nuremberg trials when they tried the Nazi criminals, Eichmann and the like. They were found to be clinically sane. Well, what's the definition of clinically insane when you are proposing this extraordinary scenario which could wipe out most people in the Northern Hemisphere?
Yes, and here's the bottom line. What they have done, what they've taken as a design for this new facility happens to be the exact measure of ground motions that destroyed the Fukushima reactors over in Japan.
Oh, my God, really?
Their design is for ground motions of 0.52 times the force of gravity.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the magnitude of ground motions that destroyed those reactors. But here's what's more important. I have determined, without question, just using Lanel's own data, that the ground motions for an earthquake, potential earthquake, at the location of this new facility will be higher than the ground motions that destroyed the reactors in Japan, and it's a value of 0.91 times the force of gravity. That's the ground motions that are necessary for the design of this building by their own data. They have missed, and they've got that data in their seismic hazard report. They just lost track of it.
Which very often happens. I'm interviewing Robert Gilkerson, who is a research scientist and geologist and was senior consultant to Los Alamos National Labs from 1988 to 1999. So with the information that you have in hand, Robert, can you go back to the National Nuclear Safety Review Board, or whatever they call themselves, and present this as you did previously with the data you had? Can you inject your information into their calculations now?
I've already made that request. Joni Ahrens and I co-authored a 43-page technical report that we submitted to the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board with a request for a meeting.
When did you submit it?
On June 28th.
Okay, so it's quite recent. So you're waiting for a reply?
We immediately received a reply. There is an unrelated lawsuit about the environmental impact statement, which is filed by a different environmental group.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
And the DNFSP immediately replied to us and said that they were asking their attorneys to see if that lawsuit would be reason that they could not hold the visit with me and Joni Ahrens.
Oh.
We haven't received an answer on that.
Okay, now I think it would be a good time to move to Joni Ahrens, who is the Executive Director of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety, an organization she co-founded in 1988. Their mission is to protect all living beings and the environment from the effects of radioactive and other hazardous materials. Since 2004, the organization has worked with the geologist Robert Gilkerson to raise awareness of the groundwater and seismic issues at the Los Alamos National Labs. Welcome, Joni.
Welcome. Thank you, Helen.
Now, I want, Joni, we have 20 minutes now to finish the program. I want you, in a succinct form, to describe to the audience what they have buried at the Los Alamos site over the last 60 years. Around the site, how much? What are the isotopes? Where are they situated? What threat they are to groundwater, to runoff into the river, the Rio Grande River, and to vegetation around there. So let's walk us through all of this now, Joni, please.
Okay. What's important is to know that Los Alamos National Laboratory is located on the Pajarito Plateau in north-central New Mexico.
Yeah.
There's a super volcano called the Valles Caldera, which sits directly to the west of the laboratory, and the Rio Grande is directly to the east.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're in an active wildfire zone, as witnessed by the recent Los Conchas fire that burned 160,000 acres. It's the largest fire in New Mexico. So many resources were put into protecting the laboratory property that the watersheds of the neighboring Pueblo community were burned. Santa Clara Pueblo, Cochiti Pueblo, and probably Santa Domingo Pueblo as well, it's going to take a long, long time for the recovery for their watersheds because of the burning that took place. So at Los Alamos National Laboratory, since 1943, when the Manhattan Project started, over 21 million cubic feet of waste are buried in unlined pits, trenches, and shafts. That's three times as what is scheduled to be disposed of at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, the world's first nuclear weapons disposal site near Carlsbad, New Mexico.
Three times the amount. So say that again, 21 million...
Cubic feet
of waste. Now, what is the waste consisting of, Joni Ahrens?
Okay, it's radioactive, toxic, and chemical waste.
And so what are the radioactive elements in that waste?
Plutonium, americium, neptunium, cesium, strontium... All the bad actors.
All right,
tritium.
Well, I just want to tell people, plutonium, americium, neptunium, those ones are called transuranic elements. They all have an atomic weight greater than uranium, and they are all alpha emitters. And alpha radiation is the most carcinogenic radiation that we know. It mutates genes. And when you get these materials inside your body, that almost certainly you'll get cancer. I mean, it's as dangerous as that. Many of them have very long half-lives. I mean, plutonium lasts for 500,000 years, to give you an example. Now, Joni mentioned tritium. Tritium has a half-life of 10.3 years, so that's around for over 100 years. That's a soft energy beta emitter, but it's highly carcinogenic, and there's a very big literature on tritium. Cesium, you all know that much of Europe is contaminated now with cesium from Chernobyl. It lasts for 600 years. It causes brain cancer, muscle cancers, and the like. And a huge area of Japan is now contaminated with cesium. And you all know about strontium-90, which lasts for 600 years and causes bone cancer and leukemia. So, Joni, go on from there. There's also toxic waste, chemical waste. What sort of chemicals are there?
Perchlorate, hexavalent chromium, solvents, just everything. And Helen, it's important to remember that Lanel used every single element in the periodic table to discover if they could be used for nuclear weapons work. And in the U.S., the Safe Drinking Water Act only addresses or requires the sampling of about 100 different contaminants. And many of the contaminants from the lab are not covered by the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Well, many of the contaminants you just mentioned, Joni, are themselves carcinogenic.
Yes.
And then there's a synergistic reaction between radioactive elements and the chemicals you just mentioned, so that one might cause cancer and the other one might cause cancer, but together, acting together, they're much more potent than they would be separately. So that's what's going on too. So we've got radioactive elements. Do you know then, Joni, how much plutonium, for example, is buried in these waste pits?
One set of experiments at the Technical Area 49 that burned during the fire, there's 88 pounds of plutonium in the soil from work that they did in the late 50s, early 60s to conduct hydronuclear tests underground. So that's just one example.
That's just one example of many, is it?
Yes.
My God.
Yes.
My God. I even wonder, how can those people go up there and work at Los Alamos with surrounded by such toxicity?
It's some of the best paying. It's the best paying jobs in northern New Mexico.
Have there been epidemiological studies, Joni Ahrens, of the lab workers and the scientists over many years? Have they been followed up until they died and autopsies done on them to see what they die of? And if so, is there a higher than normal incidence of cancer among that population and their families who live up there?
Steve Wing did a look at all of the epidemiological studies that were done.
Yeah.
For the workers, and he found that the studies were focused on the Anglo or white workers, and they didn't do epidemiological studies for the Hispanic and Native American populations.
Or the families. But what did they find on the workers?
I believe that they found elevated levels of cancer. And
There used to be a project called the Transuranic Study,
right,
which was published in the Journal of Health Physics, about workers who worked with plutonium, neptunium, einsteinium, all the alpha emitters, mm-hmm, and what they died of. And in fact, they did have quite a high incidence of cancer of various organs, liver and nasopharyngeal and lung and the like. But they stopped publishing that study, and I don't know if they stopped doing the study, in, I don't know, the mid-70s, I think, to my recollection. Do you know about this, Joni Ahrens?
Yes, the transuranic study is still going on because I've talked to workers who say that when they die, their organs are going to be part of that study.
And do you know what the results are?
No, I don't, but I think I agree with you that there's probably elevated levels.
Well, can you, Joni, I'm asking you a favor.
Oh, okay.
Can you hustle around and see if you can find out what has happened to the study, and can you get the data, please?
Okay.
Yeah, file it in the Freedom of Information Act and see if you can get the data. And if necessary, I'll help you with it. We'll do it together.
Okay, great.
Because that's a very, very, very important study.
Yes.
Okay, yes. So we've got 20, how much is it again, 21? Million cubic feet of mixed waste. It's chemical waste, it's radioactive waste. Is it buried deep or much of it is subsurface? I mean, where is it located?
Let's see, for Area G, which is a new kind of dump, they dug out 70-foot deep trenches, and they've been filling those trenches up and covering them up. In other situations, they've used the kick and roll technology where they put the drums at the edge of the canyon and kick them and let them roll down the canyons.
Roll down the canyon.
Into the canyons. And then the water comes down and carries that waste down to the Rio Grande, to our drinking water supply.
So the next logical question is, has the Rio Grande been measured for radioactive contamination and chemical waste?
Yes.
And if so, how often do they measure it? And if they measure it, what do they find?
Okay, they've found plutonium cleared 200 miles south at Elephant Butte Lake through detailed field mapping that was done by William Graff. And then also the Environment Department and the lab go out on annual sampling trips to sample the springs at the Rio Grande and biota. So there's quite an extensive program. One of the things that happened following the Cerro Grande fire in 2000, which burned 7,000 acres of Llano property, is that they changed the the significance from two sigma for error bars to 3 sigma.
Well, what on earth does that mean?
Well, it means it's an error. It's how much data they can put that's under the bell curve. And so the 2 sigma basically allowed for the area under the bell curve. The 3 sigma allows all of the outliers to be included.
Well, does that mean they're hiding data?
Yes.
Okay, just put it simply. They're hiding data. Don't use their euphemistic rhubarb language. Okay, so what are they finding in the biota?
They're finding contamination in the biota.
Yeah, and how often do they measure the biota and the water itself?
So
weekly, monthly, what?
Before this Cerro Grande fire, they were sampling everything, the vegetables, the fruit, the bees, the fish, once a year.
Once
following
a
that,
year?
Every year. And then after the fire, they changed it so that they could rotate the sampling every 3 years. Every 3 years. And so that was a big issue following the Cerro Grande fire.
What, they measure it every 3 years instead of every year following that fire?
Yes.
And that fire released huge amounts of stuff into the river.
Yes.
Well, what are they doing then? I don't understand, as a medical person and a public health person, what on earth they think they're up to, and how can they get away with this wickedness?
Because they're the largest employer in northern New Mexico.
Oh, but that doesn't wash, Joni. This is an issue of public health.
Yes,
you know,
it is.
Where are the doctors in New Mexico? Why aren't they standing up and demanding that this material be measured much more frequently and the data released to the public?
I don't know.
Okay, so next time I come to New Mexico, you'd better organize me
okay.
to speak at the hospital so I can stir up my colleagues. Now, so
we've been talking with Dr. Bernstein here in Santa Fe, and he's going to write a letter to an editorial.
Yeah, but that's not enough. We've got to get all the doctors going. So the Rio Grande supplies water to Santa Fe and Albuquerque, right?
Yes.
And farms all along.
Yes.
I wonder, well, this lab's been going for 60 years. There have been 2 major fires which have released through burning of vegetation, which was contaminated with tritium and you name it, and into the water. And then you just had a major rainfall, did you not, following this last dreadful fire?
Yes.
So that would have washed a lot of material down into the river too. I wonder what the incidence of cancer is in New Mexico.
For Los Alamos County, there's higher levels of breast cancer, prostate cancer, melanomas, some forms of leukemia.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Santa Fe and Albuquerque?
I believe it's less. We did do a study in 2004 looking at Los Alamos County.
Well, what does Los Alamos County involve? What cities?
Los Alamos County was formed out of land from several different counties, and so it's just a county, and it surrounds the laboratory.
Oh, I see. So it's going to be farmers, and it's going to be indigenous people. And it's going to be the lab workers and their families. That's
right.
Basically.
It's about 18,000 people.
That's very interesting because malignant melanomas, there's definitely an association between alpha emitting radiation and melanomas. That's, and I think that comes from the lab and also other nuclear weapons labs in America. So, Joni, where are you at? Now, you're on the program. You've got an opportunity to address the American people. What would you like to say?
That we need the United Nations to come in and do an inspection of Los Alamos National Laboratory for compliance with paragraph 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We need the world to understand that Los Alamos National Laboratory is the only place in the United States that is producing the plutonium triggers for nuclear weapons. And as Bob mentioned, the START Treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty between the U.S. and Russia, is reducing the number of nuclear weapons, and it's just insanity for the U.S. to be even thinking about the modernization program. Yeah, and Russia's already met their requirements for the New START that was just signed in April, and that we need to start working on the next nuclear weapons reduction treaty.
Rather than building more. So everyone listening to this program, you've got a job to do, and that is to go and see your congressman and senator or congresswoman and senator and let them know exactly what is going on and how absolutely criminal internationally and wicked it is. Now, Joni, what is your webpage so people can go and gather the necessary information that they require to go and speak to their congresspeople in a functioning democracy?
Yes, it's nuclearactive.org. Our page was hacked during this process of the supplemental environmental impact statement that would allow the construction of this new nuclear facility. We're still working on getting it fixed, unfortunately, but our website is nuclearactive.org.
Nuclearactive.org. And does Robert also have a website, or does he log into your website?
He logs into our website.
Okay. Well, look, I thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Yes, for appearing on this program and telling us exactly how really criminal the United States is at the moment in the international sphere of nuclear weapons production, and how people must rise up Egyptian style in America to stop this criminality. So thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for this interview, Dr. Caldicott. Could I make just one more point?
Yes.
There is a outstanding alliance of senior nuclear weapons scientists who are now retired, and they are known as the Jasons.
Oh, I know, yeah.
They are opposed to this plan to construct new
yes.
nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And they're pointing out that our current inventory of nuclear weapons have a life of longer than the next 100 years.
Yes, I'm very much aware of that. I've written about it in my book, The New Nuclear Danger, Robert, if you'd like to look at that book. I wrote at length about the Jasons and their study.
I will look at that.
Yes, and thank you very much, Robert. It's been a great pleasure to interview you.
And I share the pleasure, and thank you very much.
Thank you. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was a registered geologist, Robert Gilkinson, and also my guest was Joni Ahrens, who is the Executive Director of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety. I don't know if you feel the same sort of heartthrob as I feel when I interview these people about the criminality of the American domestic and foreign policy in terms of nuclear weapons. You see, what I didn't mention today too during the interview was, apart from the weapons lab actually blowing up in a massive nuclear explosion, releasing 6 tons of plutonium if there's an earthquake beneath the lab, the fact is that these weapons, they want to build more. And if we have a nuclear war, and we could tonight, because Russia and America still have each about 2,000 hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert, which only take half an hour to go from launch to land, and the whole thing, nuclear war's over in about an hour, and it could happen by hackers hacking into the early warning system, could happen by computer error, it could happen by an aberrant, deviant commander of a Trident submarine who could, in fact, launch a nuclear war without communicating with the Pentagon or the White House if he got his 2IC to comply. There are many ways a nuclear war could start. And so we all still are dangling from the sword of Damocles by a silken thread every single minute of every day. And the fact that these characters are intent on building more new nuclear weapons, which will trigger a new nuclear arms race, not just with Russia, because she always has to keep up, but with China and God knows who else, is absolutely beyond comprehension. Beyond comprehension. The answer to salvation only lies in your hands, nobody else's, because it's America that's doing this. And it is potentially a functioning democracy. And unless you rise up and move from your Facebooks and your computers and decide that you have enough time in the day to lead a movement to stop this absolute crazy irrationality, we're doomed. I, as a physician, looking clearly, prognostically at the future, just now in terms of nuclear weapons, let alone global warming or more meltdowns, just from nuclear war, I have to tell you, the prognosis is really grim. And I'm not sure if we're going to make it. We can. We absolutely can. But the only way we can is if all of you listening to this program, and there are enough people listening to this program, get off your behinds and your couches and your chairs and get out there and stir up the bushes and, you know, go and see all your elected representatives, who are your servants. You are their leaders. They are your representatives. But by God, it's going to take a lot of work. And I know about that because I've spent the last 41 years of my life doing this, much more actively in the past, I must say, than now. And now I guess the flame of the torch for salvation and survival passes to you. Here endeth my soliloquy. Thanks for listening to this rather depressing but profoundly important program, and we'll be with you again next week with another intriguing and hopefully not so depressing program. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.